the Army, and I think it was Clark that was the commander of the 1st Army, and we were a spearhead. And Patton was with the 3rd or 7th Army?
3rd.
3rd, okay. And then we had the 7th Army to the north of us, and Patton, old blood and guts, he ran through and made a big name for himself and probably shortened the war. But we had to clean up all the stuff that he left, so that the doughboy, the infantry guys, hated his guts because there were a lot of snipers out there.
We're going to take a 2-minute break.
Warren, let's go back. We had you at Remagen. It's an important episode in the war. The powers that be committed a lot of troops, a lot of paratroopers to the effort. Talk to us about that battle, what you saw, why we didn't capture the bridge and hold it. What happened?
Well, our orders were to go to the Rhine River, and we were trying to establish a way to get across the Rhine River. And our orders, my battalion, is to go to the Rhine River and stop. And I think, and I'm only surmising, that it was an agreement that the Russians were going to go into Berlin first. And all of a sudden, here's this bridge that had just the skeleton crew on, and that I found out later that the Germans had put demolitions on that bridge to blow it up, and they didn't go off. So that we just shot the heck out of those Germans that were on that bridge and took it. And we established a bridgehead about 50 yards, I think, beyond that bridge. And now what do we do with it? Hey, we need help, you know. And the purpose of, well, our purpose, was to put treadway across. That was a railroad bridge. And our job was to put treadway across there to get our troops and our tanks across there. And the Germans knew exactly what we were doing. And the minute we started working, it was like 4th of July, that they threw everything at us, and there were planes that were swooping down over that bridge, dropping bombs, and then disappear over another ridge at the other side. And we set up artillery and machine gun fire that had zones of fire, and every fifth bullet, I think, was a tracer, or maybe it was more. But at any rate, you know, it looked like the whole sky was lit up with those tracers. And, you know, that was only one of five. And, you know, I remember a P-38 that the Germans had captured, and this pilot was flying there, and he was shot down, and the front end of that P-38 was big and long, and it went straight down into the ground, and we went to capture this guy, or what was left. And the plane burned so that he was nothing but charcoal. You couldn't touch him, that he would just fall apart. And it's just an illustration as to the Germans had our equipment, our uniforms, our dog tags, whatever. They were well prepared. But, you know, they didn't have the American pride and the gung-ho thing that the Americans had.
So you captured the bridge, but you couldn't hold it. Then what happened? Did you get orders to retreat, or
no? We did hold it, and our job was to get it ready for getting our tanks and men across. And we added so much weight to that bridge, Faye, that it fell on its own accord. And I remember I was an officer talking to another guy that I relieved. That he had people stationed in strategic places for protection. And we were going over those things, and all of a sudden, we're at the east side of the bridge, at the abutment, and it was like machine gun fire. and, you know, we all went down on the ground or whatever. It was the rivets popping out of that bridge.
Yeah. Wow.
And that's when that thing fell.
So then, obviously, nobody could cross it, and so you had to back up, and...
We held that area, and then we got a pontoon bridge across the Rhine that would suffice until we got some more bridges across there to the north and the south of us.
But the notion was you had to capture at least one bridge across the Rhine to help shorten the war, to literally
ferry your own
armies
over. Well, the fact that we got troops across the river, which could have been a major battle, and here it was handed to us, and we were able to get it. And there was also a mountain just beyond the bridge that we could establish a bridgehead and then fight the Germans on the other side of it. But, you know, it was such a maze. And I remember crawling away from that bridge and through cow dung and everything else, and didn't even realize that you're so full of this stuff. And we were taught to cradle your rifle between your elbows to make sure it didn't get dirty. And when I got into a farmhouse or a barn, I remember I looked at my rifle and I couldn't have fired that thing if, you know, if the Germans had captured me. But we were scared. And you know, you hoped that your country would come to your help if you needed it, and where are the reinforcements and whatever. It was a scary time.
The elements were keeping the supply from coming in.
The elements, I've never been so cold in my life.
You're from Buffalo.
Yeah, and it was colder there. And I remember we had half tracks, and we had rations in cans and put them against the motor of the half track to warm it up so that, you know, you could eat it. And we couldn't light a fire. That's another thing about baseball of fate, is that when I came back after the Army, I thought, wow, you know, if I don't do well, nobody's gonna shoot me.
Yeah.
And secondly, that I could change my clothes and take a shower. There were days, weeks, maybe even months, that we couldn't even take our shoes off. And, you know, your shoes and feet would get cold and whatever, and your socks were wet all the time. And
well, they said trench foot was the biggest problem.
Yes.
The clothing was so poor, and so many of the troops had. Wasn't it Cecil Travis who froze some of his feet, and he never was able to play as well?
I think you're right.
He was at the Bulge, and he...
You're more of a historian than I am. I think that's a true story.
He was a great ball player, and he never played well because his feet got so frozen at the Bulge.
I've always had the philosophy that you can't appreciate until you've been deprived. And I think my service helped me with my baseball career, that what a wonderful world this is. What a wonderful country we live in. What an opportunity to play baseball for a living.
Man.
And it was all attributed to the things that we were deprived when we were in service. And we were the best trained, best outfitted army in the world.
Can you talk about just the emotion when the weather clears and the supplies that you talk about, the best equipped, the equipment starts coming in because the planes can get through and you can get the relief you need when you knew that the lifeline was reestablished? Just talk about the emotions of that day when the supplies started reaching
in. I don't know if there was such a thing as a day. We felt good about the fact that the German populace were surrendering to us because they felt like we were less humane, or more humane, rather, than the Germans were. And everybody would have their hands up and say, "Nix Nazi," and they wanted us to capture them. That was an indication of things to come. As far as the end of the war, one of the reasons that I took my battlefield commission is that I thought when the war was over in Europe, I was going to have to go to Japan and fight.
Yeah.
And I thought that as an officer, I'd have a better chance of coming back to play baseball again as an officer.
Did you see any other ballplayers, any other guys you knew?
No.
During the Army? And secondly, did you ever think about the risk to your arm? I mean, obviously your arm was an important part of your future. Did it ever occur to you that, no, I can't be surprised
no.
at that.
Well, when I was talking about cradling your rifle in your arms, mm-hmm. we were crawling on our elbows.
Yeah.
And, that was a part of my life that I hoped would happen.
But it was a long way away.
I didn't know how many days, how many years, or whatever. And I think you live for the present rather than the future. And I think you'd go stir crazy if you thought about the duration of the war and how long it would take and whatever.
And when did you leave Europe? Were you there when the war ended, or were you still in Europe, or had you come back before it ended?
Well, Faye, when I accepted the lieutenancy, I was stuck in grade for a year, so that my company was sent back to the United States. I was hoping they'd mess up the paperwork that I could go home with them. And I knew I was going to have to spend a year in grade. But I was the only officer, and I was the commander of my company. And I had orders from headquarters to be prepared for 100 plus 10% overload to send the 276th Combat Engineer Battalion home. Well, 2 days before they were ready to go home, I was transferred. And I wound up in a general service regiment, and I wound up in Nuremberg refurbishing a German hospital for our people. And I had a whole bunch of German people working for me, and they went out on strike. Can you imagine that?
Mr. Spahn, I know that the Battlefield Commission was very important, but I also know that you won the Purple Heart. What you suggest?
Well, I got hit by shrapnel, and it wasn't anything that maimed me, but my commanding officer felt that I should be entitled to the Purple Heart. So I received the Purple Heart, and I'm very proud of it. But I think of all the guys that lost arms and legs and half of their body, and I didn't feel that I was entitled to it, but you don't question an honor such as that one.
I want to go on to baseball. I don't want to leave that period in your life. Are there other things that you want to talk about for people a long time from now?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that when I came back to baseball, which was 1946, and Billy Southworth had remembered me from when I was pitching before World War II, and he gave me an opportunity to start. And I won my first start, and he is responsible for me being first a starting pitcher. And the opportunity to, get an opportunity to show my wares. And
your first win was in 1946. You were 25 years old.
Yeah.
So I often say to people, Warren Spahn won 363 games and didn't win a game till he's 25. But I don't tell them where you were for those years between them.
Hunger makes a big difference. No, there were 10 pitchers on the ball club. And, we had four, maybe five people that were starters, and the other people were in the bullpen. Well, I wanted to be one of those starters because I wanted to be a guy that played every day, and I couldn't do that. And you sort of feel like you're a part of the ball club when you're a starting pitcher. And
who were the other pitchers? Was Sane there?
Johnny Sane was one of them. Ed Wright, a right-handed pitcher, who had a malfunctioning leg, and I don't remember which one it was now, but Al Javery, Bill Posdell, some others I'll think of later, but oh yeah, I got an opportunity to get my foot in the door, and I wasn't going to let anybody take it out. And
how much had you lost? I mean, obviously you lost 3 years. You hadn't pitched much in that three-year period.
None.
If at all. And so you came back, and all of a sudden you're trying to throw the ball over the plate. What was that like? I mean, you hadn't thrown hard.
I think it was like when I left for the service and when I started, when I came back was like yesterday. And, you know, I think I was lucky enough to remember how to throw.
Did you notice any difference? Did you feel that you lost some speed? I mean, was there any difference?
We didn't have a gun.
So I know, but I mean, you're in your own mind. Were you about what you were when you went, or were you different?
The hitters tell you a story. I don't know. And I know that if I threw a fastball by a hitter, I was throwing pretty good.
Yeah.
And if I threw my curveball and they swung over the top of it, that was pretty good too.
So you don't think you really were any slower, that the fastball was about as good in 46 as it was?
I honestly can't answer that question. I know that...
It was good enough anyway.
It was good enough and a confidence factor, and I was thankful that I was there. And I didn't want anybody to take that away from me, so you try harder.
One more time on the maturity. Obviously, having fought in a war, you saw some horrible things. You went through a terrific maturing process. And I think you just said to us that was all very good for your career. Spell that out a little bit. I mean, obviously baseball had less significance to you in one sense. You saw people getting blown up and shot.
Well, let me say this, that the guy that pitched before I went in the service was a different guy than the guy that came back. My confidence level was so much better. Again, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? I felt that I could do my job. And my son was born in 1948, and I felt like I couldn't afford to lose. I couldn't afford to fail. You know, that's the responsibility I felt.
Let me ask you a question about the other veterans. I mean, Hauk came back. He had a great record in battle, as you did. Lou Brissy was pitching for the Athletics. He had part of his leg shot off. Did you guys feel any sort of identity among one another in the big leagues when you saw these guys on the field? Did you have any sort of camaraderie because you've been over there and had
fought?
Well,
I don't think so, Faye, because those guys you're talking about played in the American League.
Yeah.
And I can't think of anyone that was in World War II in Europe when I was there.
In the National League.
Yeah, in the National League, right. And it's kind of like two separate parts of your life. And I think that all of us felt like, let's forget that part of it and go on with the rest of your life. And I will say this, that I am grateful to my military service. I'm grateful that the disciplines and whatever, I thought it made me a better ball player. And I hear so many of these people that come out of Korea and Vietnam are crying about a drug habit that they had accumulated and whatever. Maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't. But I know I, for one, was thankful that I had the, you know, the travesty of the service to fall back on, and bases loaded and musial hitting, it wasn't as important a factor.
It wasn't Malmedy, right?
Right. And yeah, it helped you through tough times. And
I believe that.
I think that tougher good times are self-created. And I remember pitching a no-hitter when I had two outs, ninth inning, and I went to reach for the rosin bag, and my hand was shaking. I thought, you stupid jerk. Why wasn't it shaking the first out of the inning, or the first inning? And, you know, all these things are invented within your own mind. I think that's the biggest problem with baseball and a lot of things, is that God created man with a mind, and sometimes it betrays him. So I think that thing of positiveness and intelligence have to be cultivated. And
how about the guys that didn't go? Was there any feeling on your part, any resentment, any sort of negative reaction to the guys who played ball during the war and somehow missed
it? I don't think that there was ever any thought like that, at least with me. I was just happy that I got back. I think Tommy Holmes never went in the service, but he had a reason for not, you know, a physical reason for not being there. So I don't think that was ever something we thought about. We were just glad to be back. And we felt that, hey, now the major leagues are the major leagues, because all the people were back that played before, like the Williams and DiMaggio, et cetera.
You said that you had the confidence, you knew that you were a different person. Was there ever any fear that because you left as a rookie and not an established star, that somehow baseball might forget you? Was it that one person who remembered and brought you back?
That's what I said about Billy Souther. He gave me an opportunity to go out there and prove what I could do. And I could have sat on a bench for 3 months or the rest of the year and not pitched. So I'm grateful for that, grateful for the opportunity.
Talk about the first win. I mean, obviously you won 363. Can you single out win number one and talk to us a little bit about
what
that meant? Tell us about the game and how it
went. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Okay. My first win, I'm trying to think. Should know this. I was thinking about the first game I pitched after I came back from the service. And I pitched against Pittsburgh, and Frankie Gustine hit a home run off me in the ninth inning, or I would have had a shutout. But my first win in the big leagues, I was hoping it would be in the Polo Grounds. And this is before I went into service. And they had a deal at the Polo Grounds where kids could get in the ballpark.
This is when they had the riot or something, and you lost the win, right?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a riot, but they let the kids in with like 5 pounds of scrap metal. And in the seventh inning, they allowed these, or the kids, I guess the ushers went home, and the kids all came down in the lower part of the grandstand, and then they came out on the field to get autographs. And we're behind at the time, and the loudspeaker said that if they didn't get off the field, that they're going to forfeit the game to the Braves. Well, I was the pitcher of record when that did happen, and I remember Babe Barna hit a double off me in left center field. But anyway, we were behind, and now we won the game 7-0 because of the forfeit, and I was hoping that I'd get the win. But all the records, the hitters, their times at bat and whatever counted, but the pitcher's records didn't count. So I didn't get my first victory.
So you got your first win after the war. Billy South was the manager for the Braves.
Right.
Was that a good team? I mean, obviously you win the pennant a couple years later.
Well, I don't say it was a bad team, but it wasn't the greatest team.
The Cardinals won that year with a good team, obviously. Musial was...
Yeah, 46, that's when Slaughter scored from first base.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of older guys. Billy Southwood brought a lot of ex-Cardinals over, like Ray Sanders was the first baseman. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time remembering that ball club in 46.
Now in 46, Jackie signed with the Dodgers, and obviously baseball was going to change. You're in the Braves. What was the reaction when the first black guy signed? Did you think of it as a historic event? Was it something you paid the attention to?
Well, I felt that we were the big leagues, and we played a World Series. So if we played a World Series, then we should be able to play against the best of every nation, black, white, yellow, green, or whatever. And Jackie was a good talent. And he could run like a deer. What tickled me is that, you know, we heard about Jackie, and he was but Branch Rickey picked the first black guy in baseball because of his college education, his athleticism, and I understand from other black people that the catcher in the Negro League was a better ball player than Jackie.
Josh Gibson.
But Jackie fit the mold that Branch Rickey wanted to break the color line with. And I remember Branch telling us, and I don't know whether this was at a banquet or not, but he said that he tested Jackie and said, "Now what happens if somebody calls you a nigger?" And Jackie says, "I'll punch his lights out." And he said, "No, you'll blow the whole thing." So Rickey wanted to mold this person as being, you know, somebody to represent the black community. And Jackie was good. Jackie was a fairly decent fielder. He had a good arm. He could run like a deer. And he hit the ball from left center to right center, I think. He hit the ball to right center better than anywhere. And then he got the immunity of the commissioner of baseball that we weren't allowed to call him anything racial. And so Jackie took advantage of that. And every time a call strike was called on Jackie, he complained to the umpire about it. And I was pitching, like, Sane pitched the first game against Jackie, and I pitched the second game. And I remember that I threw a pitch down the middle, and Jackie took it for a strike, and he complained about it. And we had Walker Cooper catching, and Walker was a big son of a gun. And he said, "Get back in there, Blue Gums, or I'll shake you out of your uniform." Well, he didn't call him black or anything else, but Jackie took offense to that. And then Cooper stood up. And when Cooper towered over him, he got back in there and hit. But, you know, that's a tough role for anybody to be the first. And I think Jackie handled himself pretty darn well. Pee Wee Reese befriended him. Dixie Walker was from the South and didn't like being on a ball club with Jackie. But anyway, all those things are a part of our history. And I remember Jackie wound up playing second base because he got heavy and